I've never felt like this before. It's like you just get me. I feel like my true self with you. Does that sound crazy? And it doesn't hurt that you're gorgeous. Okay, that's it. I'm taking you home with me. I mean, you can't find shoes this good just anywhere. Find a shoe for every you from brands you love, like Birkenstock, Nike, Adidas, and more at your DSW store or DSW.com.
A match made in hell. I can only describe the deeds and relationship that allowed a twisted couple of Fred and Rosemary West to exist, as they would live to commit at least 12 murders together over 20 years. What drove this couple to such extremes, and how did they keep their murders under wraps for so many years? That's what we investigate in part two today of the Fred West story on the dark side of Wikipedia.
Sometimes the human mind goes to dark places. Sometimes those dark delusions turn into a reality. A reality so shaded and gray, once all is said and done, the healthy mind is drawn into the documented retelling of these tragic events, trying to find logic, reason, and understanding where there may be none at all. This is the Dark Side of Wikipedia.
Part 2. Murder of Catherine Rena West. Rena maintains sporadic contact with her children. On each occasion, she and Fred separated. She's also known to have visited Moorcourt Cottage to inquire as to her children's whereabouts and welfare in the latter half of August of 1971. Fred's sister-in-law, Christine, later recollected Rena was depressed and extremely anxious about her children's welfare. Being provided with Fred's Midland Road address, Rena sought to confront him, likely to discuss or demand custody of her daughters. This was the final time Rena was seen alive. She's believed to have been murdered by strangulation, possibly in the backseat of Fred's Ford Popular, and likely while intoxicated. When her body was discovered, a short length of metal tubing was found with her remains, leaving an equal possibility she had been restrained and subjected to a sexual assault prior to her murder. Rena's body was extensively dismembered, placed into plastic bags, and buried close to a cluster of trees known as Yew Tree Coppice at Letterbox Field, about 1 mile from Much Markle. On the 29th of January, 1972, Fred and Rosemary married. The couple took place, and the ceremony took place at Gloucester Register Office, with Fred incorrectly describing himself as a bachelor upon the marriage certificate. No family or friends were invited, apart from Fred's brother John, who acted as best man. Several months later, with Rose pregnant and her second child, the couple moved from Midland Road to an address nearby, 25 Cromwell Street. Initially, the three-story home was rented from the council. Fred later purchased a property from the council for £7,000. To facilitate the West purchasing of the property from the council, many in the upper floor rooms were initially converted to bedsits to supplement the household income. To maintain a degree of privacy for his own family, Fred installed a cooker and a wash basin on the first floor landing in order that the lodgers need not enter the ground floor where the West family lived, and only he and his family were permitted access to the garden of the property. On the 1st of June, Rose gave birth to a second daughter. The date of her birth led Fred and Rose to name the child May June. Shortly after giving birth to her second child, Rose began to work as a prostitute, operating from an upstairs room at their residence and advertising her services in the local Contact magazine. Fred encouraged Rose to seek clients in Gloucester's West Indian community through these advertisements. In addition to her prostitution, Rose engaged in casual sex with both male and female lodgers within their household and individuals Fred encountered via his work. She also bragged to several people that no man or woman could completely satisfy her. When engaged in sexual relations with women, Rose would gradually increase the level of brutality to which she subjected her partner, with acts such as partially suffocating her partner or inserting increasingly large dildos into her partner's body. If the woman resisted or expressed any pain or fear, this would greatly excite Rose, who would typically ask, "Aren't you woman enough to take it?" To many of these women, it became apparent Rose and her husband, who regularly participated in threesomes with his wife and her lovers, took a particular pleasure from seeking to take women beyond their sexual limits, typically via sessions involving bondage, as the West openly admitted to taking a particular pleasure from any form of sex involving a strong measure of dominance, pain, and violence. To cater to these fetishes, They amassed a large collection of bondage and restraining devices, magazines, and photographs, later expanding this collection to include videos depicting bestiality and graphic child sexual abuse. Rose controlled the West family finances, Fred giving her his pay packets. The room Rose used for prostitution was known throughout the West household as Rose's room, and had several hidden peepholes allowing Fred, a longtime voyeur, to watch her entertain her clients. He also installed a baby monitor in the room, allowing him to listen from elsewhere in the house. The room included a private bar and a red light outside the door, warned when Rose was not to be disturbed. Rose carried the sole key to this room around her neck, and Fred installed a separate doorbell to the household, which Rose's clients were instructed to ring whenever they visited the house. Much of the money earned from Rose's prostitution was spent on home improvements. By 1977, Rose's father had come to tolerate his daughter's marriage and to develop a grudging respect for Fred. Together, he and Fred opened a cafe that they named the Green Lantern, which was also insolvent. When Bill Letts discovered Rose's prostitution, he would also visit to have sex with his daughter. By 1983, she had given birth to 8 children, at least 3 of whom were conceived by clients. Fred willingly accepted these children as his own and falsely informed them the reason their skin was darker than that of their siblings was because his great-grandmother was a black woman. When each of the West children reached the age of 7, they were assigned numerous daily chores to perform in the house. They were seldom allowed to socialize outside the household perimeters unless either Fred or Rose were present, and had to follow strict guidelines imposed by their parents, with severe punishment almost always physical being the penalty for not conforming to the household rules. The children feared being the recipients of violence from their parents, the vast majority inflicted by Rose, occasionally by Fred. The violence was sometimes irrational, indiscreet, or just inflicted for Rose's gratification. She always took great care not to mark the children's faces or hands in these assaults. Heather, then her younger brother Stephen, born in 1973, ran away from home. Both returned to Cromwell Street after several weeks of alternatively sleeping rough or staying with friends, and both were beaten when they returned home. Between 1972 and 1992, the West children were admitted to the accident and emergency department of local hospitals 31 times. The injuries were explained as accidents and never reported to social services. On one occasion, as Stephen was mopping the kitchen floor with a cloth, Rose accidentally stepped into a bowl of water he'd been using. In response, Rose hit the boy over the head with the bowl, then repeatedly kicked him in the head and chest and shouted, "You did that on purpose, you little swine!" On another occasion, Rose became furious about missing a kitchen utensil, then grabbed a knife she had been using to cut a slab of meat, repeatedly inflicting light scour marks on May's chest until her rib cage was covered with light knife wounds. All the while, May screamed, "No, Mom, no, Mom," as Stephen and Heather stood by, hopelessly sobbing. Even Fred occasionally became the recipient of Rose's violence. On one occasion in August of 1974, Rose chased after Fred with a carving knife in her hand. Fred was able to slam shut the door of the room into which she had run as Rose lunged at him with the knife, resulting in the knife embedding itself in the door, and 3 of Rose's fingers sliding down the blade, almost severing them from her hand. In response, Rose calmly wrapped her hand in a towel and said, "Look what you've done, fella. You've got to take me to the hospital now." She sounds like a lovely lady, a real catch.
Oh my God.
If you will.
You know, in the first half of this, I mean, she was really bad.
Mm-hmm.
But he sounded worse even.
Yeah.
And then now it's like she is just fucked up.
Yeah. Two utterly
and
insane
people. The stories, you know, it's like, do whatever you want. If you're an adult and you're a consenting adult, and if you want to be a prostitute, and if you want to do all this shit, I don't understand the deal with her father, but like, just don't have children. And then she has so many of them.
Yeah.
And then horribly abusive. And then the mom comes to get the 2 kids back, and then she ends up dead. Like, why?
And she's fucking her dad.
I mean, it's just all of that. And
yeah. And it sounded like there was animals involved at one point too.
They said bestiality.
I know.
Like, what? I just can't even. Like, you know, I understand how some people go down the wrong path in life. Like, yeah. I get that. But I don't even understand this path. Like, I don't.
You know, I mean, like, she's
I get, like, I just, but this is just so far beyond anything that I can comprehend. And as you're reading this, it just gets worse.
She's someone who obviously, you know, you don't necessarily come out this way. She suffered, obviously, a lot of abuse in her own life. But as a result of all of that abuse, she was so damaged that, I mean, there's a point where I think there's a point of no return. And once someone is that damaged and this is just the norm, you're not going to get them out of it. They're just going to continue to abuse others. What do you do with somebody like that? You know, I mean, other than just everybody run for your fucking life and don't get involved. But that's the problem. Not everybody, you know, it's not like she's necessarily
children
sitting there.
Children can't run.
Well, exactly. Exactly. But, you know, adults can. But that's the thing. She's sitting there with someone who also encourages the abuse, makes it normal in their little ecosystem. And it's all normalized and it's all okay. So in their world, it's okay. This is her job. She can fuck dad and goats and whatever that and she wants and
poor children.
Yeah, I mean,
like I don't understand any of that, but whatever.
Yeah.
But you know, then she's so horrifically abusive to those children.
Yeah.
They're innocent kids. I just child abuse is something that. I know.
Like, when you start reading about it, like I start looking forward to the part in the entry where it's like, and she died. At least I hope
we
get to
yet?
It. No, we're not quite.
She's dead yet?
I don't even know if she's dead. So,
can she please die a horrific death?
We'll hope that. We'll definitely hope for that. But we'll see where this goes and where it continues. Cool. And the Fred and wife's story. As we continue, in September of 1972, the Wests led 8-year-old Anna Marie to the cellar at 25 Cromwell Street, where the child was ordered to undress, with Rose tearing her dress from her body upon noticing the child's hesitation. She was then stripped naked, bound to a mattress, and gagged before Fred raped her, with Rose's active encouragement. After the rape, Rose followed Anna Marie to the bathroom, handed her a sanitary towel, then explained to the child, "Everybody does it to every girl. It's a father's job. Don't worry and don't say anything to anybody." Making clear these sexual assaults would continue, Fred and Rose then threatened the child with severe beatings if they ever received word she had divulged the sexual abuse she endured at their hands. Rose occasionally sexually abused Anna Marie herself and later took extreme gratification in degrading her with acts such as binding Anna Marie to various items of furniture before encouraging Fred to rape her and forcing her to perform household chores while wearing sexual devices in a miniskirt. From the age of 13, Fred and Rose forced Anna Marie to prostitute herself with the household, with her clients being informed Anna Marie was 16. Rose was always present in the room when these acts occurred to ensure Anna Marie did not reveal her true age. On one occasion, when Anna Marie was age 13 or 14, Rose took her to a local pub, insisting she drink several glasses of barley wine. Several hours later, Fred arrived to the pub to collect Rose and Anna Marie. Once they had left the premises, Anna Marie was bundled into her father's van and beaten by Rose, who asked her, "Do you think you could be my friend?" before she was sexually abused by her father and stepmother. In October of 1972, the West hired 17-year-old Caroline Owens as their children's nanny. They had picked her up one night at a secluded country road as she hitchhiked from Texbury to her Cinderford home, having visited her boyfriend. Learning that Owens disliked her stepfather and was looking for a job, the West offered her a part-time employment as a nanny to three children. Then in their household, with the promise she would be driven home each Tuesday. Several days later, Owens moved into 25 Cromwell Street, sharing a room with Anna Marie, whom Owens noted was very withdrawn. Rose, who had begun to engage in prostitution by this time, explained to Owens that she worked as a masseuse when the younger woman inquired about the steady stream of men visiting her. According to Owens, Fred also said she was a skilled abortionist who was available should she ever need such a service. Owens also noted Fred talked about sex almost incessantly. Her suspicions as to his sexual overtones were further heightened when Fred boasted that many of the women he claimed to have performed abortions upon were so overjoyed that they would offer him their sexual services as a reward. When Owens herself became the recipient of West's overt sexual advances, she announced her intentions to leave Cromwell Street and return home. Knowing Owen's habits of hitchhiking along the A40 between Cinderford and Tewksbury, the West formulated a plan to abduct her for their shared gratification. Fred later admitted that the specific intent of the abduction was to rape and likely murder Owens, but that his initial incentive was to determine whether his wife would be willing to at least assist him in an abduction. On the 6th of December 1972, the couple lured Owens into their vehicle with an apology for their conduct and an offer to lift home. Initially, Owens believed the West had been sincere in their apologies, and to her they obliged, believing she had simply mistaken their earlier intentions. Rose joined her in the back seat with the explanation that she wanted a girl's chat as Fred drove. Shortly thereafter, Rose began to fondle her as Fred questioned whether she had had sex with her boyfriend that evening. When Owens began to protest, Fred stopped the car, referring to Owens as a bitch, punched her into unconsciousness before he and Rose bound and gagged her with a scarf and duct tape. In her subsequent statement to police, Owens stated that at Cromwell Street, she was given a drugged cup of tea to drink, then again gagged and subjected to a prolonged sexual assault from Fred and Rose. At one stage, Fred remarked that Owen's clitoris was unusual, then lashed her genitals with a leather belt. When Owen screamed, Rose again smothered her with a pillow and further restrained her about the neck and performed cunnilingus on her. Quickly realizing the gravity of their situation, Owens ceased resisting their sexual assaults. The following morning, having noted Owen screaming when one of his children had knocked on the door of the room in which she was restrained, Fred threatened that he and his wife would keep her locked up in the cellar and allowed his black friends to abuse her, and that when they had finished, he would bury her body beneath the paving stones of Gloucester. Fred then claimed he had killed hundreds of young girls, adding that Owens had primarily been brought to the house for Rose's pleasure. He and Rose then calmly asked Owens whether she would consider returning to work as their nanny. Seeing her escape avenue, Owens agreed and vacuumed the house to include her belief in becoming an extended member of the family. Later that day, Owens escaped from the laundrette she and Rose had entered and returned home. Although initially too ashamed to divulge to her mother what had happened, when her mother noted the welts, bruises, and exposed subcutaneous tissues on her daughter's body, Owens burst into tears and confided what had happened. Owens' mother immediately reported her daughter's ordeal to the police, and the West were asserted and charged with assault, indecent assault, actual body harm, and rape. The case was tried at Gloucester Magistrates Court on the 12th of January, 1973, but by this date, Owens had decided she could not face the ordeal of testifying in court. All charges pertaining to her sexual abuse were dropped, and the West agreed to plead guilty to the reduced charges of indecent assault and causing actual body harm, which resulted in a fine of £50, and the couple were allowed to walk free from the court. When Owens heard this news, she attempted suicide. 3 months after the West assault trial, the couple committed their first known murder. The victim was a 19-year-old named Linda Goh, with whom Fred and Rose became acquainted through a male lodger in early 1973. Goh regularly visited Cromwell Street and engaged in affairs with two male lodgers. On the 19th of April, she moved into their home on Cromwell Street. On about the 20th of April, other tenants were told that she had been told to leave the household after she had hit one of her children. The story was repeated to Glau's mother when she contacted the West to inquire about her whereabouts. Rose had been wearing Lydia's clothing when she repeated this claim. When Gao's dismembered body was found, the jaw was completely wrapped in adhesive and surgical tape to silence her screams, and two small tubes had likely been inserted in her nasal cavities to allow breathing. Long sections of string and sections of knotted fabric were also discovered with her remains. Gao had likely been suspended from holes carved into the wooden beams supporting the ceiling of the cellar. Fred later admitted he had devised the purpose of suspending his victims' bodies and likely died of either strangulation or suffocation. Her dismembered body, missing 5 cervical vertebrae and a palate and numerous phalange bones, was buried in an inspection pit beneath the garage. From their later investigations, police and forensic experts concluded all the victims found in the cellar of 28 Cromwell Street had been murdered in this location, and that, like Gao, each had been dismembered in this location. 5 victims were murdered and buried in the cellar at Cromwell Street between November 1973 and April 1975. The first of these victims, 15-year-old Carol Ann Cooper, who was abducted on the 10th of November, 1973. Cooper lived in the Pines Children Home in Worcester and was abducted after spending the evening at a cinema with her boyfriend. She'd been waiting for a bus in Warden when she vanished and was likely dragged into Fred's car, where her face was bound with surgical tape, her arms bound with braiding cloth before she was driven to Cromwell Street. At the West address, Cooper was suspended from the wooden beams of the cellar ceiling before her abuse and murder. As had been the case with Lydia Cooper, who died from strangulation or asphyxiation before her body was dismembered and buried in a shallow cubicle grave in the cellar. Over the following 17 months, four further victims between the ages of 15 and 21 suffered similar fate to that endured by Gow and Cooper. Although the acts conducted upon each successive victim, plus the paraphernalia discovered in each shallow grave, suggest each victim was likely subjected to greater abuse and torture than those previously murdered. Following the murder of 18-year-old Juanita Mott in April of 1975, Fred concentrated over the floor of his entire cellar. He later converted this section of the household, He later converted his section of the household into a bedroom for his oldest children, and he and his wife were not known to have committed any further murders until May of 1978, when Fred, either with or without Rose's participation, but certainly with her knowledge, murdered an 18-year-old lodger named Shirley Robinson. Robinson had first met Fred at the Green Lantern Cafe in April of 77 and had taken lodgings with the Wests the same month. She was heavily pregnant at the time of her murder. Although Rose herself, pregnant at the time, initially boasted to neighbors the child Robinson was carrying was her husband's, she soon developed a deep resentment of Robinson, and the motive for her murder is likely to have been the removal of a threat to the stability of the West relationship. Her body was buried in the garden of 25 Cromwell Street. It was extensively dismembered, but no restraining devices were found with these remains, making a sexual motive for this murder unlikely. The unborn baby had been removed and had several bones missing. Shortly thereafter, Rose unsuccessfully submitted a claim for maternity benefits in Shirley's name with Gloucester Social Services. As had earlier been the case with Charlemagne and Linda, Fred and Rose allied the suspicion of anyone who asked about Robinson's whereabouts by claiming she had relocated to live with her father in West Germany. The final murder Fred and Rose were known to have committed with the definite sexual motive occurred on the 5th of August, 79. The victim was a 16-year-old named Allison Chambers, who had run away from the local children's home to become the West live-in nanny in the middle of 1979. Chambers is believed to have lived with their household for several weeks before her murder, and Rose promised Chambers that she could live at the rural peaceful farm she claims she and Fred owned. Her body was also buried in the garden of Cromwell Street, close to the bathroom wall. And although Chambers was likely dismembered, her skeleton was not marked by anything that the earlier victim's body had been. In an effort to allay any concerns from Chambers' family, with whom she maintained regular correspondence, Fred and Rose later posted a letter written by Chambers to her mother prior to her murder from a Nordo Chaperhan post box. Heather and Mae West became the focus of Fred's incestuous sexual attentions after Anna Marie ran away from home in 1979. After enduring a particularly severe beating from Rose to her stomach just days after being discharged to the hospital for treatment of ectopic pregnancy, the frequency of the abuse endured by Heather and Mae increased when both girls reached puberty. Fred was overt and unapologetic in his conduct and would justify his actions with a simple explanation: "I made you, I can do what I like with you." He further referred to his intentions to impregnate both his daughters on at least one occasion and would occasionally force all his children to watch pornography with him. As Heather, May, and their young brother, Stephen, were very close in age, this trio resolved that if their father asked either of the two girls to be alone in a room with him, they would only do so if at least one other member of the trio were present to avoid either girl being raped. Both girls also developed a regimen whereby they would only shower or undress when their father was either out of the house or as her sister stood guard at the door. Stephen was also informed by his father that he would have to have sex with his mother by age 17 in the event his parents evicted him from their home when he was 16. Although the girls were repulsed by their father's behavior, May having once endured Fred's throwing a vacuum cleaner at her when she was doing things against his father fondling her, developed a mechanism whereby she would tolerate Fred sexually fondling her, then jokingly brush aside any efforts he made to take the molestation further. Whereas in her autobiography, May recollected that Heather was affected quite badly by all this, more than me. A strong suspicion remains that by 1985 or 1986, Heather had been forced to engage in intercourse with her father, as by the mid-1980s, she developed classic symptoms of the distress felt by victims of child abuse. These included habits of biting her nails until they bled, drinking alcohol, or warily watching her father through the corner of her eye wherever she was sitting or standing, expressing nervous fragility whenever in the presence of males. Her sleep being repeatedly broken by nightmares, and her repeatedly bouncing back and forth as she sat on a chair. This distressful behavior led Fred and Rose suspecting Heather had lesbian inclinations and also resulted in her becoming the increasing recipient of taunts from her father, who had never particularly held a liking towards Heather, that she was ugly or a bitch. On the occasions Heather complained about the abuse from her mother, Rose would simply laugh at her distress. Rose also expressed to May and Stephen her desire to run away from home and to live a nomadic lifestyle in the forest of Dean, and to never again see any human beings. Heather did complain to friends about the abuse that she and her siblings endured, and her external signs of psychological distress were noted by several of them. Staff at the Hullicoats Secondary School, which Heather and her siblings attended, are also known to express concerns as to why Heather, a studious and obedient pupil, refused to obey orders either to change her clothing for or shower after sporting events. On one occasion, she was forced to take a shower, resulting in her peers and staff noting her arms, legs, and torso were covered in welts and bruises in various stages of healing. Heather attempted to excuse these injuries as having been obtained in fights with her siblings, but confided in one close friend that they had been inflicted by her parents, adding that her mother considered her a little bitch who deserved her beatings. By the mid-1980s, rumors of Rose's sex life had reached several of the children's classmates, and although the West children had been instructed never to divulge details of their home lives to their peers, Heather confided to her friends that many of these rumors were true. The father of one of these classmates was a friend of the West. As such, word soon reached Fred and Rose that Heather had divulged details of her home life, including details of her mother's promiscuity, to her classmates. Fred was also concerned by these revelations that he began to escort Heather to and from school. After Heather left school in 1986, she applied for numerous jobs in an effort to leave Cromwell Street. By June of the following year, she had pinned her hopes on escaping the household via obtaining a job as a chalet cleaner at a holiday camp in the seaside town of Torquay. She received notification that this application had been unsuccessful on the 18th of June. In response, she clumped into tears before her siblings May and Stephen. That same evening, her whole family heard Heather sobbing aloud as she attempted to sleep, and according to May, she cried all the way through the night. The following morning, on the 19th of June, Heather was back to her usual self, looking miserable, biting her nails, and sitting on the couch, bouncing back and forth as she sat. As her siblings left the house to go to school, when Heather's siblings returned home, they were informed Heather had left to accept a job she had previously been refused in Torquay. Although Rose told an inquiring neighbor that she and Heather had had a hell of a row, and that Heather had run away from home. Later, to answer their children's question about why Heather failed to contact or visit her siblings, the parents claimed that Heather had eloped with a lesbian lover. When May and Stephen suggested they report Heather's disappearance to police, Fred changed his story yet again, saying it would be unwise to initiate a search for Heather as she was involved in credit card fraud. On more than one occasion, Fred and Rose persuaded an unknown acquaintance to fake a phone call from Heather to her parents. In the years following Heather's disappearance, Fred occasionally jokingly threatened the children that they would end up under the patio like Heather if they either misbehaved or divulged the mistreatment they endured to anyone outside the household. With Rose's approval, he later constructed a barbecue pit immediately opposite where Heather had been buried and placed a pine table on her grave for the children of the family to sit upon whenever the West held family gatherings in their garden. Heather's disappearance, Fred and Rose's constant changing stories about their daughter's whereabouts, plus their allusions of foul play, ultimately led to police inquiries as to Heather's whereabouts. These inquiries culminated in a search and a warrant being issued to excavate the West garden in February of 1994. So, where do you want to start unpacking that pile of shit?
Christ. Like, I just don't get it. And my heart just breaks for those kids. You know?
I know.
And, like, I mean, brave enough to actually speak out, but then she was killed for it.
Yeah.
You know? Like, I don't even, and the only thing out of all that shit that I actually was like, okay, if all of these details are known, that means that somebody made it out alive.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was the one thing I was thinking. And then you said one of them wrote a memoir.
Yeah.
And how do you end up going on? Like, can enough counseling really help you through that? Like,
no.
Can it really help you process that?
No. I mean,
it makes me so sad. Innocent children born into this world to be treated like that.
Mm-hmm.
That just bothers me.
It's insane. I mean, it is utterly insane.
And it's just so calculated and cruel and.
What I find,
there's so many,
really bizarre and interesting about this is you have two people working hand in hand to do this shit. Normally, mm-hmm. it's like one person because right. two personalities.
She's as bad.
Yeah.
You know, the story started and you think he's the bad guy.
Yeah, they're just as bad individually.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like normally you don't have two personalities that can work hand in hand like this because one's going to overpower the other and one's going to kill the other at some point. But it seems like there's just this perfect match of insanity here that allows this to just thrive. It's a match made in hell. I mean, it really is.
It really is. Really is.
And
it's like, how do two people who are so twisted find each other on this planet? You know, like, how? How could you find someone who's like, not only willing to go along with you, but is even worse than you?
Yeah, because it's not like one is sitting there being codependent and just like, okay, I'm not going to say anything. They're fucking doing their own shit, too. They're just like one-upping yeah. each other left and right. And yeah, it's God. It's just fucking amazing. Well, eventually
God,
they do get arrested.
My heart.
We'll jump into the arrest portion here.
Are they dead yet?
That's the
good part.
That'll probably be next episode on this because this is going to be a three-parter. But we'll jump into the arrest portion of their story. In May of 1992, Fred asked his 13-year-old daughter, Louise, to bring some bottles to a room on the first floor of their home. Rose was not present in the home at the time. Shortly thereafter, the girl's siblings heard her later scream, "No, don't!" Later, Fred returned downstairs. Louise was found by her siblings, withering in pain, sobbing that her father had raped and sodomized her, at one stage partially strangling her. When Rose returned home, Louise confided in her mother that she had been raped by Fred, and Rose replied, "Oh, well, you were asking for it." Over the following weeks, Louise was raped on three further occasions, with Rose personally witnessing one of these rapes before following her distressed and bleeding daughter into the bathroom and asking the child, "Well, what did you expect?" Fred also filmed one of these rapes. Several weeks later, Louise garnered the courage to confide in a close friend what her father had done. His friend told her own mother what had happened on the 4th of August. In response, the friend's mother anonymously informed the police. On the 6th of August, 1992, the police searched the West household on the pretext of searching for stolen property. Although numerous objects of sexual paraphernalia, including 99 pornographic videos of both homemade and commercial nature, were discovered, police did not find the video depicting the rape of Fred's daughter. The 13-year-old made a full statement through a specially trained solicitor, describing the father's actions, the fact the sexual abuse had begun when she was 11, that her mother had been casually indifferent in her plight. All the children in the household were placed in foster care the following day. Medical examinations revealed evidence of physical and sexual abuse. The West children also divulged their mother had inflicted most of the physical abuse and that their father frequently said that if they told anyone about the goings-on in the household, they'd be buried under the patio like her sister Heather. Police began a full-scale investigation, eventually leading to Fred being charged with three counts of rape, one of burglary, with Rose as an accomplice. She was also charged with child cruelty, inciting her husband to engage in sex with her daughter and obstructing the police. Fred and Rose were questioned as to their whereabouts of their eldest daughter, and although Fred claimed Heather was alive and well and supporting herself via prostitution, Rose initially claimed to have no knowledge of Heather's whereabouts or why she had left home. She also claimed on the 11th of August that she could remember now that her daughter had left home at her own persuasion due to Rose's concerns her other children may discover Heather's supposed lesbian inclinations. Rose also added she had also given her daughter £600 as an incentive to leave the household before further claiming to have maintained sporadic telephone contact with her daughter over the years. The following day, Rose was granted bail on the condition she did not maintain contact with her children, her stepdaughter, or her husband prior to her upcoming trial. As Fred awaited trial, he was held on remand in Birmingham. Learning that her father had denied any wrongdoing, Anna Marie also contacted the police to offer a full statement detailing her experiences as a child. In a statement given to Detective Constable Hazel Savage, Anna Marie recounted the extensive physical, mental, and sexual abuse she had endured as a child at the hands of her father and stepmother before agreeing to testify against both parents at their upcoming trial. Anna Marie also added she had for several years been unsuccessfully attempting to trace her mother Rena and half-sisters Charmaine and Heather. Further inquiries conducted with Anna Marie's husband, Char Davis, revealed that Heather had confided in him just how unhappy she was shortly before disappearing and of her desire to leave home. Davis elaborated that although Heather had not divulged any details about her enduring any sexual abuse, she had been so concerned for her welfare, he had offered to confront Fred and Rose, and Heather had discussed him for dissuaded him from doing so, blurting, "For Christ's sake, don't, because they'll kill us both." Davison suggested that they might wish to speak with Heather to garner further details of her abuse. In their efforts to gather further evidence, police and social services also spoke with May, who had having spoke with her 13-year-old sister and learned Louise did not wish to see her father charged, initially denied she had endured any molestation as an adolescent. Police then focused their attentions on tracing Heather in efforts to corroborate Anna Marie's claims of sexual abuse, but inquiries to the Inland Revenue and Social Security Department held no records addressing or attesting to her being alive. 2 months later, Gloucester Social Services also contacted police to stress their concern of the whereabouts of Heather. The case against the West collapsed when Anna Marie and her 13-year-old half-sister Louise declined to testify at a court case in 1993, with a child rape victim expressing her desire to return to her family, and Anna Marie choosing to withdraw her statement because of her noting the misery of her younger siblings and her fear of Rose's vindictiveness. Shortly thereafter, Anna Marie spoke further with D.C. Savage, further emphasizing that her mother, Rena, and half-sister Charlemagne were also missing. Though the West were acquitted of all charges, all their younger children remained in foster care, albeit with permitted supervised visitation to Cromwell Street. Despite Fred and Rose claiming to the few relatives from whom they were not already estranged by 93 that the charges had been fabricated by the police, almost all their remaining family members severed contact with them. Meanwhile, police continued investigating the disappearance of Heather, noting no records existed indicating she was still alive. When Anna Marie was questioned as to the colloquial family joke regarding Heather being buried beneath the patio, she confirmed that the sole time she had heard her father recite this claim, he had immediately burst into laughter, leading to her refusing to take this claim seriously. In retracting Fred's history, police also discovered that although Rena and Charmaine had disappeared in 1971, no missing person report had ever been filed on either of them. D.C. Savage and her colleagues were convinced Heather was dead, and that Fred's repeated statement to his children that her body lay beneath the family patio might be true. On the 23rd of February 1994, Gloucester police successfully applied for a search warrant, authorizing the search of 25 Cromwell Street to locate Heather's remains. When police displayed this warrant to Rose on the 24th of February, she turned pale before becoming hysterical and shouting over her shoulder to her eldest son, "Get Fred!" Rose became contradictory in her informal questioning as to the circumstances surrounding Heather's disappearance. When reminded of these contradictions, she became distraught and abusive, shouting at the officers, "I can't fucking remember. It's a bloody long time ago. What do you think I am, a bloody computer?" Fred had been working in Stroud at the time. Upon hearing of the police intentions, he assured Stephen he would be home immediately. When Fred arrived 3 hours later, he informed his family of his intention to voluntarily offer a witness statement to police regarding his daughter's whereabouts. Despite Fred's insistence in the statement that Heather had been alive and well, albeit involved in drugs and cartel, that the claims he and his wife had made to Heather being buried beneath the family patio were simply rubbish, police were unassured. In response, Fred abruptly changed tactics, claiming they simply held a grudge against him due to his 1993 acquittal of the rape of his daughter. That evening, with the search team having left the premises and uninformed officer remaining at Cromwell Street to guard the excavation site, May and Stephen observed their parents talking in hushed tones as they repeatedly glanced toward the garden from their kitchen window. Kind of nervous, I guess, when the police are sitting there ready to dig up the garden. What do you think they're going to find?
Oh, my God. Like, just that whole her freaking out. I'm like, finally.
Yeah.
Finally. It's just so sad. And I get why the kids, you know, that's intimidating.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you're deathly afraid of your parents.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just sad.
I think what's amazing about this story is the fact that this is before the days of meth. You know? Because this totally could be like a meth case where they're just totally out of their minds on meth. But they're not. They're just totally out of their fucking minds.
Sorry, my dog's barking.
Even the dog's just completely disgusted with this.
Well, at one point, because you always turn my microphone off when you're talking about this. And at one point, and I don't even know which disgusting point, buddy, stop. I just yelled, oh my God. And Bud got up to see if I was okay. And my dog is very hard of hearing. I was just so disgusted.
I know.
Oh, it's just sick.
This is like one of the worst stories ever.
This is the worst. Everything about it.
And what's surprising is it's fairly unknown. Like, there's not more about this. I don't know. Is it too extreme that when people are like thinking of making documentaries about shit, it's just like, yeah, it would be a really interesting documentary, but to tell the full story would just be too much and nobody would watch it, you know?
This is hard to listen to. I couldn't imagine.
Yeah.
Ugh. It's just so, you know, there's just kids involved and it's just so sad.
What's so disappointing is the police, I mean, we're talking a different time too. There wasn't DNA and all that other shit. But I would think today, if people kept saying there's a body under the porch, he's joking about a body under the porch, there's like three people with direct connection to these people that are literally missing.
And no one can find this person.
And he's being accused of rape, and he's being accused of this and that, and the family seems to be doing this shit together. Why did it take till 1994 to finally look under the goddamn porch?
Yeah.
I mean, like, why?
And, you know, there's so many people that failed those kids along the way. I mean, there's men and women in and out of that house all the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're just as sleazebaggy and horrible as those people.
Yeah.
You know, because there was kids involved.
I know.
And I do think that, you know, like whatever the equivalent of DCF is over there, but, you know, I know that then it was harder to get them involved in cases. I don't know how it works in England.
I don't know.
But they have to have an equivalent.
They have to have
a governmental, you know, because they went into foster care.
Well, and what was
so
the version? And what was the version of it in, you know, the late 70s and early 80s, all of the 80s and early 90s? You know, it's, you know. Those things, you know, they're not the greatest to begin with because they're usually not staffed as well as they should be. There's not enough funding for it. I mean, the people who are involved in those, you know, civil, you know, cases where it's what's the position? Social workers and things like that. Mm-hmm. So I know many, they're super well-meaning, wonderful human beings, but overworked to the fucking death. And you can't realistically, you know, ask them to, they're not equipped to do the amount of work that needs to be done in many of these cases for the well-being of the kids. And it's no fault of their own. They're doing the damn best that they can. But of all the things that we throw funding at and things like these are just like, when we talk about just decency to human beings, we don't seem to put money on things like that. Things that involve mental health, things that involve all the things that lead up to people like this existing. And then when they're there, it's still very much glossed over until really a lot of shit happens. And there's, it's just, it's insane. But And especially well, this, that far back.
This story is just so beyond anything. I mean, it's just so beyond, you know, and just, and it's horrific abuse.
It would make horrific. A great musical, wouldn't it? You know, a Broadway
Not
musical.
Really. I mean, I'm going to have to disagree with you on that one.
The worst fucking musical in the world.
Oh, my God.
I mean, like people walking out of there, so their just like jaws drop, like they just saw like the
people
worst.
People throwing up, just right and left.
Oh my God, fucking craziness!
So there's a whole nother part of this one. Then
we're gonna go into the discoveries of what happened, of what the police found, into the trial, and even more on our next episode. So this goes to a part three, and then the final chapter will be following that for our Darksiders. So
I just hope there's some kind of justice in all this. Like no, not even justice. I want there to be like these
death.
People are just like really the worst thing ever happens to them. You know, they rot in a cell by themselves.
Yeah, like lit on fire. Know. Something like that.
I know I sound like a horrible person maybe, but
no,
you know, I just want it to be like, okay, it was okay for you to do that to children. How about this?
Motherfuckers like this need to die. And that's really all there is to it. And
but not even just like in a nice way.
No, it's, I mean, I know like the arguments are always like, well, you know, it doesn't work when you make examples. I don't know. Maybe if we did more burning at the stake of people like this.
Honest to God, these people, it wouldn't faze them.
It wouldn't.
So you can have
right.
like this, if you're ever caught, you know, doing something like this, you're going to be drawn and quartered. You know, like some horrific medieval death.
Yeah.
Because those people in the medieval times.
They were creative.
Like, they were pretty brutal in the death sentence. And even then, they'd be like, I'm not going to get caught. I'm too smart.
And that's the thing. You're right. It probably does not deter because they're so twisted already to do these sort of things. And there's nobody that's like on the edge of doing these things. I think it's either you have the ability to do this or you don't. There's no like, oh, I'm contemplating. Maybe I'll work my way up to that. No. You either have this or you don't. And let's hope to God you don't, because it's pretty fucked up. But my God. Fred and Rosemary West, part three coming up on the next installment of The Dark Side of Wikipedia. So stick around for that. Press subscribe wherever you download podcasts so you don't miss anything. Until next time. For Carol, I'm Tony. Thanks for listening to The Dark Side of Wikipedia. And I want to get this in here too quick. Social media. People want to follow you. What do you want to push? Where?
Instagram. You can follow me on Facebook. But Instagram, Carol Hughes.
At Carol Hughes. I am at Tony Brewski on Instagram. I'm also on TikTok now. At Tony Brewski as well. Tony, Brewski. Be sure to follow. I've been playing with TikTok a lot the last couple of days, and I've been even doing like some like 60-second kind of murder stories that we've talked about.
You've had some fun videos lately.
Yeah, I had one that went viral today. I was kind of excited. Like my first TikTok video ever went fucking viral. I'm like, all right, maybe I got a knack for this TikTok thing. And I wasn't even shaking my ass and like dancing to, you know, booty shaking music at all. It was my animals. So anyway, follow us.
That was funny.
Yeah. Follow us on social media. Until next time, for Carol and Tony, thanks for listening to Dark Side of Wikipedia.
Prescription products require completion of an online medication consultation with an independent healthcare provider through the LifeMD platform and are only available if prescribed. Subscription required. Individual results may vary. Additional restrictions apply at LifeMD.com. Read all warnings before using GLP-1s. Side effects may include a risk of thyroid C-cell tumors. Do not use GLP-1s if you or your family have a history of thyroid cancer.
Confused on where to start with weight loss medication? See the lowest prices available with or without insurance for Wegovy, Zepbound, and more at TryLifeMD.com. 95% of LifeMD patients said starting their weight loss journey was simple. Listen to Tara's story after losing 42 pounds.
You just take your shot. It doesn't feel like you're on a diet. What I wasn't expecting it to do was to shut off the food noise. I had gone from 237 to 195. This was life-altering, and if I can do it, I feel like anybody can do it.
Get your free insurance benefits check in minutes right now at TryLifeMD.com. Nearly 96% of patients said they would recommend the LifeMD program to anyone who wants to lose weight. Get started right now at TryLifeMD.com. That's TryLifeMD.com.
If you're shopping while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast, then you know and love the thrill of a deal. But are you getting the deal and cash back? Rakuten shoppers do. They get the brands they love, savings, and cash back. and you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Target, Nike, and Instacart. Stack sales on top of cash back and feel what it's like to know you're maximizing the savings. It's easy to use, and you can get your cash back sent to you through PayPal or check. The idea is simple. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back. Download the free Rakuten app or go to Rakuten.com to start saving today. It's the most rewarding way to shop. That's Rakuten, Rakuten.com.